Day is September 18, 1986, Holden Village. I guess we'll get started. I'm just passing by here, and they asked me if I'd give a little bit of a talk about my experiences. On board, it was talking about survival experiences, but actually, we'll get into a little bit of that. But mostly, it'd be my personal experiences that's taken place in Alaska, our so-called last frontier. In some of the survival experiences that I have had, I think we put too much emphasis on the fact of what we learn in books, and we go on survival expeditions. We've had survival experiences in the military. Some of us read a lot of books, but I think I put a lot of emphasis on attunement. Attunement meaning to let's say this is what was behind the Indian prayers and in the sweat house ceremonies that they used to have. What they was looking at is the ability of his and her mind to divorce herself of all other concerns and to blend so well with the environment that he becomes one within one of body, mind, and spirit. Now, if you talk to hunters, you talk to naturalists, this is exactly what they do in order to get closer to the environment and to the animals around them. That they'll more or less become part of nature. And when you become part of nature, you're able to get closer. The animals aren't quite as scared of you. For a good example, is right here in Holden Village. If these animals were scared of you, they wouldn't be coming this close to you. I'm going to tell you a couple experiences that I'm going to have a kind of question and answer time. If you've got any questions, I'll try to answer them. Try not to make them too difficult, because mine's not too bright. I went to Alaska in 1980. Got a job as a fishing guide. Worked up there for a company called Alaska River Safaris. Ron Hyde was the owner. The first year I was up there, I went up there in 1st of October. Stayed up there till the 1st of June. During this period of time, since I got up there in October, everybody else flew out about the 2nd of October. So I have 9 months up there that I'm by myself. Nearest village is 70 miles away. I have a radio for communication, but if anything seriously happened, there would be, by the time they got in there, it'd probably be too late to do any good. So you got to be extremely careful when you're up there. A little minor things that kind of happened to me that you might be interested in. They had a generator out there, had two 12-volt batteries hooked up to the generator. Evidently, they hadn't used any water in the batteries all winter or all summer. So when I went to start it up, about the first cold day we had, didn't get any spark to it, so I jiggled a cable, and of course this spark ignited fumes and the battery blew up about 2 feet from my face. Luckily, I wasn't hurt. I had a lot of black and blue marks on it. But I'm sure that there was a dog up there for a companion. And I know she thought I was crazy because I'm jumping out and running across the field here and jumping off a cliff in the water because I want to splash my fumes out of my face. But what I'm saying is there's several different things that can happen unexpectedly out like that, and you don't know, you never expect it. I was out there for, like I say, 9 months. I was running a trap line. I ran across a couple of young Eskimo Indians, Indian boys, that came up to do some trapping around the area that I was at. This, it had started freezing. We had a fresh snow on the ice out there. And they got a little bit too close to the bank, and they went through a spring, and it was practically froze from the waist down when I come across them. I was about a mile from the cabin, and of course all their matches were wet. There wasn't hardly anything around there to start fire with. So I was able to I had a couple blankets with me. I took with me a sleeping bag. Was able to warm them up and build a little travel and drag them back to the cabin where I kept them for 2 or 3 days. Got them warm and fed them and was able to get them back to the village. Got a hold of contact with some other people who came after them. When I returned to the village, and another thing I want to get into is a little bit of the Eskimo culture. I'm going to try to cover about 5 or 6 years and 2 or 3 topics here within the next 20 minutes. But when I returned to the village that next summer, and they recognized me and they introduced me to the members in the village, and all the people in the village, you got to understand, are nieces and nephews and cousins and brothers and sisters and moms and dads. Just about everybody is interrelated one way or the other. So when I received, came into the village, they recognized me and they introduced me to the village, to their aunts and uncles and cousins and whatever. But I started learning the customs of the Eskimo people, which are, they're very, very, live a very simple, a life of simplicity. It's a fishing community, most of the villages. They use 15-foot V-bottom, mostly skiffs, with seines. They go out there and drift seine, and then the process barges come in close to the area. They take the boats out there and sell the fish to the process barges right there. They don't fish every day. They fish to get enough money for what they need. And that's the reason that they're really upset with a lot of the white men that comes in there to take everything that they got just to look for the money. Even the guide services coming in there. You really get upset about that because fish is a very, very sacred to them because that's their sole mean of income. They do a little bit of trapping in the wintertime, but generally in the summertime it's just mostly fishing. One of the things that they do look for, the only thing that they've got to do in the summer and even in the winter, is they look for an excuse to have what we call potluck dinners. Niece, cousin, nephew, whoever, has a birthday or anniversary or something, that gives them an excuse to have some type of get-together. And they do have some get-togethers. They have all kinds of foods. I'll go into a little few of them. That's interesting. One is seal flippers. That's always nice to chew on. If you like to, if you got wearing leather sole shoes, you like to take them off and start chewing on them. That gives you an idea of what seal flippers taste like. Fish heads. That's always an interesting subject. Maybe we better not talk too much about that this close to dinner time. They have all kinds of other recipes. They've got a type of bird there. It's kind of like a blackbird, I think, they fix. And kind of reminds me of eating your own canary. You got your blackbirds, you got, they fix a lot of fox too. You got a lot of fox around there. Kind of beaver, all kinds of different fish, of course. They smoke a lot of salmon. Have salmon throughout the year. But they accepted me pretty well in the village to the fact that I wasn't asking a lot of questions. You get a lot of clients in there, come there for fishing for a week, and they want to find out as much as they can about the Eskimo culture within that period of time, so they start asking a lot of questions. And Eskimos are very reserved. These are the Yupiks Eskimo. They're very reserved. They're proud of their culture, and they save a lot of the information for somebody that they really want to share it with. So if fishermen come in there and they try to drag this information out of them, of course, one of their favorite expressions is, "What do you want to know for?" And they're very proud. They're very careful who they share their information, their heritage with. Since we've got about, I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions, let me just have a question and answer period here, and I'll try to answer a few of the questions that you might come up with.
How do they, you said the Indian boys had a snowmobile. How do they get the snow, how do they get a snowmobile?
Okay, that's what they use a lot in the wintertime. They use snowmobiles that they bring in on the barges.
Can they afford a snowmobile?
Oh, absolutely. They'll do their fishing in the summertime, and they'll, just about everybody has their own boat there. So it's nothing to make $300-$500 a day fishing. And a lot of times the fishing is regulated by the federal government, which they may set up 2, 3, 4 times a day, or 4 times a week. So depending on the they have fish counting stations on up the river, and ladders to determine the amount of salmon coming up the river, and that's how they determine how many days a week.
Are they paid a certain amount, whether they fished or not, each Eskimo?
No, definitely not.
Now, I've heard that the federal government kind of more or less has a home guard, and they got a lot of equipment like snowmobiles and stuff, and they station where they get these people in these different far off villages, snowmobiles and equipment, so kind of keep track of what's going on along the coast. Is that correct?
Not in the villages that I'm familiar with, no. What has happened as far as allocating money to the Eskimos, to the different villages such as the Aleuts, the Alabaskans, is that the federal refuge land is, our federal government has come in there and set up federal refuge land around. And some of the, it has taken in some of the villages and some of the personal dwellings of the Eskimo. And they pay these people a certain amount of money per month, depending on, you know, how much land they have. But what happens, these people have been used to such a simplicity of simple living that it drives into these bigger communities. Dillingham, for instance, which is a lot of these villages are dry, but Dillingham is not, so they can get all the liquor that they want there. Anchorage, of course. And you go to Anchorage, and a place called, it's actually 4th Avenue, they call it 4th Street. And that's where a lot of the Eskimos and the other tribes hang out. They don't know what to do with this money that the federal people have given them each month. So it takes them about 2 or 3 days to drink it up. And then they're living on the sidewalks, and of course they've turned to alcoholics. In the wintertime, it's not uncommon for them to froze to death in the alley. So it's really a sad situation. Yes.
What type of religion do they have in these villages?
They believe in one God. They are a Christian type people. I don't know the name of the church that they call it. It's nothing anything that we'd be familiar with. I have attended the preachings and sermons on Sundays, and I just know enough. Yupik just to catch bits and pieces of it. Mm-hmm. But that's quite a thing to be, as a white person, to be, or if they call you Gusick, to be invited to their church.
Right. You were talking about food. It's all meat, huh? What about fruits and vegetables and stuff? Is there a chance to grow anything?
They don't have time to grow much fruits and vegetables down there in the southwestern part where I was. Now up in the Matanuska Valley, Delta Junction area, between Fairbanks and Anchorage, there's quite a farming community up there. They raise corn, beans, wheat, just a regular farming community. And in the summertime, you've got the daylight hours are 18, 21, 22 hours of sunlight each day. And that's the reason many of you might have heard of the size of the cabbages and corn and wheat and everything that grow up there, and that's the reason. It's because they are have so much daylight hours during the summertime.
Well, if you went to an average family potluck kind of dinner, would it be mostly meat stuff?
Mostly meat and fish. Now, you do have a grocery store within this area, yeah, down there where I'm at, and they do get fresh vegetables in. Yeah. And, you know, you get eggs and cereal, milk and things. But very few people buy a lot of these items because, you know, you just don't feel like paying $4 or $5 for a gallon of milk or $4 for a dozen eggs.
So it is mostly meat, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you have the heart attack are pretty low because of all the fish oil.
Yeah. Of course, some of the government, I'm not too familiar with them, other than the fact that I do know they have been doing some research on, you know, fish as a as Eskimo diet, and of course Japanese and some of their diets. Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about what type of terrain you were surviving in Alaska and how you did it?
Okay, a couple, two or three different areas. One was down there in southwestern Alaska, which is mostly tundra area. Tundra, if you're not familiar with tundra, tundra is it's a very beautiful land. It's a real spongy. If you took a pickup truck and load it about halfway up to the side, the back end with sponges, and then tried to walk in it, that kind of gives you an idea of what it's like to walk on the tundra. In the wintertime, it's no problem at all. It's in the summertime, it just absorbs the water and gets real spongy and squishy. Now, the tundra makes a good sod house. So it insulates well. The roots underneath the tundra, you've got jillions of them, small, tiny roots that holds the earth together. That's about the only thing in the tundra area as far as building for a survival shelter. There's not much wood around that area. Along the rivers, you'll find some, but mostly they make sod houses in the tundra area. There's, as far as, you know, there's a lot of fishing there. Alaska is a little bit different fishing than this area and most areas in the lower 48 here, to the fact that people think I'm pulling their leg when I tell them you just put your lure on a fishing pole and go out in the middle of the lake and drop your line, and by the time it drops, free falls 10 or 15 feet, you've got a 3.5-pound trout on there. True story.
That's not true of every lake.
No, but most of your remote lakes is still true of. But you get up around Anchorage area, Fairbanks area, it's not only the tourists, but also the population of that area goes to the immediate lakes around there, and it's pretty well fished out. Yes?
Seems to me you need to have a variety of skills in order to survive. Could you just give us an idea of what skills you come into this with and what you've learned?
Okay. One of the skills you need, first of all, you need a positive mental attitude when you're out there. And what I mean by that, if you go out there with the idea, say you're on a plane crash, but you're out there with the idea that you're not going to survive, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's not going to be a high percentage that chances are you're not going to survive. As far as the skills, There are so numerous that it's hard to pinpoint any one particular thing. I've used the example most people can relate to, the cattail plant down here, and that's a supermarket and hardware store, I feel, within its own, because trying to give you an example how to use the different parts of it. The root, for instance, the root can be eaten raw, or it can be boiled and eaten, or it can be dried and pounded into flour or powder and used as a flour. In the fall of the year, you have a sprout that comes up about 6 inches, looks like a stuffed pepper or something, that can be unfolded, and that inside of it can be eaten raw, or it can be boiled also. The shaft of the cattail plant is extremely straight, very good to make arrows with for your bow. The top of the cattail plant, the brown sausage-like, in the spring of the year, when it's before it gets the fuzz to it, it can be used as I've cut it open and fried it just like sausage. Don't particularly taste like sausage, but it can be. The leaf itself, the reed, if you've ever torn that apart, you get a sticky substance out of there. That's a very good antiseptic. It's got a numbing agent that you can use for toothache medicine also. the reeds of the cattail plant can be used for weaving, good insulated material, make baskets, make clothing out of it, if you like. I don't know if that kind of answers your questions as some of the survival things that you can, some of the things that you can use for making survival equipment and apparatuses.
How would you catch a fish?
Well,
you didn't have any hooks.
Well, I was going to say, I'm kind of cheating. I'm taking some hooks with me. thorns, if you're in an area where you got thorn bushes, that makes an excellent hook.
You
can use a spear. You can set you a fish spear, fish traps. Utilizing the cattail reed, you can make a fish trap cone shape situation that the fish comes into to the cone, to the big end, and of course they don't come back out through the spawn, they've gotten trapped in it.
But with your minimal tools, you can actually make a bow and arrow situation that shoots with accuracy?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can. The best bow that I can give you a quick example. Excuse my artistic ability.
Just erase that word fear. And anxiety.
We better leave that up there. We may need it. It doesn't make that much difference the type of wood you got to use a double bow. If you'll get you a limb about an inch and a half in diameter, like so. And of course, you've got a curved tip like this. Get you another one, like so. And then you stretch your line or string across there. You can even weave pieces of dead grass together time and time again to get your strength for your string. You bring a string up here and tie it to here. Then when you draw back, you're actually drawing this one back, and it's tied into this other one that goes the opposite direction. So you're actually getting more strength. If that kind of answers your question.
How much are you carrying with you? Are you carrying that?
No, about 35 pounds.
That doesn't include a sleeping roll?
No.
Or tent?
No, what I utilize mostly is what's called debris shelter. Debris shelter is put together with utilizing a debris material that you find in the area without destroying the live habitat. And that's one of the reasons I'm trying to put this book together, is to show this. For instance, say that you're out there, you find a stump, say about 3 feet high. Find you a pole, 6-8 inches through is preferable. The length can determine with your body length. Put one in on the ground, the other one rest up on to the stump. Find you some other limbs about as big around as your forearm to use as ribs. They'll actually go down from the ridge pole at a 45 degree angle down to the ground. Find you some branches and weave in and out of the ribs to keep any of the debris from falling through. Then you find leaves, moss, cattails, depending on what area you're in, anything that's a good insulator. And you just build that on top of that. So you've got an area you want about 3 foot thick from the inside out. In severe cold weather, that's what I'll be putting together this year. Then when you've got that insulating material on there, then you lean up bark slabs or heavy branches or whatever to keep this from wind from blowing this away. This, just utilizing your body heat in that will keep you warm, I say warm, about 60 degrees, down to 30 below, 35 below zero.
What's on the floor?
Well, okay, besides that, you pack the inside with leaves and also this insulated material. And you just crawl in there just like you're in a cocoon and use part of it for the door. As a door plug, also.
What is in your 35 pounds a year?
I've got, I'm taking some nylon rope with me. I've got I've got some matches. I've got I'm taking some extra socks and some long underwear and some a heavy jacket. And I am taking a, I'm cheating, I'm taking a blanket with me. I will admit. But just mostly the bare essentials. Most things that I'm taking with me are, if we're simulating an airplane crash, is probably what you would find, but you could rummage through the airplane and come out for a survival type situation.
What? This is for how long a period?
Well, it's going to be 10. For 10. How long it takes me to get the information together? I'm field testing some survival knives for different companies this year. In fact, I had about 5 or 6 of them that I started putting them to field test these as far as building shelters, setting up traps, snares, and things for game, and things like this.
Do you cook and eat in another shelter then, or this sleeping area is just big enough to crawl in and sleep in, isn't it?
It is. What I'll do, I'll have 2 shelters built for 2 different reasons. One, in case something does happen, because of it being a debris-type shelter, it can, be destroyed, especially by fire, very easily. Also, if you're out there in 20 below zero or even zero weather, and it does catch fire, then you want something that you can go to. I'll build another area specifically for a work area. Then it can also...
How warm does that one stay when you're... That's one you can stand up in, I suppose.
Right, to be able to stand up in it. It'll just be for a work area and for an emergency shelter in case something happens to the other one. Then you can modify it accordingly to that.
You don't have a fire inside of that second shelter then? Keep you warm?
It depends on what type of shelter it is. If you're in an area where you can build, if there's a lot of fallen logs and things, you can use logs and use mud and grass and straw, for cement between the logs. Yeah, you could work something up for the fire in. This particular shelter that I'll be, the debris type shelter, if it gets so cold that you want to build some type of heat in there, what you can do is build a trench. And I've done this before, about 6 or 8 inches deep, 18 inches wide, and 5 or 6 feet long. And you can heat rocks on a fire. Line this with rocks and then cover it back over with the dirt, and you can lay right on top of that. It's just like a heating pad.
You don't bring a shovel along?
No.
Where are you going to do this?
I'm going to start up toward the Glacier Peak, and then I'm going to head back down toward Mount Adams, so it'll be in the lower elevations.
You built your shelter before the snow, and there's 10 feet of snow. Is it caved in or
do you ever use snow to insulate your house when it...
Okay, this is kind of a question comes, goes right together here. The shelter, when I build it, the snow that falls on top of the shelter acts as an excellent insulator.
Mm-hmm.
Snow is a good insulator as long as it's kept directly away from your contact with your body.
Mm-hmm. I'm having a debris shelter with the snow that comes on
and
can
relax this morning. Oh, absolutely.
What do you do for trapping supplies?
Snares, traps.
Any kind of string or something for those?
Well, I said I did have a nylon rope that I'm taking with me. It's just small nylon rope.
Oh, it's a small rope.
Small cord is about what I'm next to. There's a lot of different ways to set up snares and traps and things. One of the things that, especially for smaller animals, we're all familiar with the mice around this area, I'm sure. Ground squirrels, mice, or whatever. What you can do is... if you got your ground level here, and build your little pit here, put you a couple rocks here, and put you one flat rock across like this. It's an excellent way to catch... field mice, even squirrels, ground squirrels, chipmunks, snakes. You can get snakes in there. What happens? You walk through the area and you scare them out. They see this area here. They crawl under this rock and they fall down this pit. So, but you want to be careful to remove that that rock and see what you're reaching for when you reach down in there to get one.
How about clothing? You know, it doesn't sound like you're packing in much clothing. What are you going to do for winter?
How do you wash?
Okay, two questions. First of all, I'm going to... I've got a permit from the government that I am going to be able to, you know, do some hunting. I am going to tan some hides up there.
Okay.
Hopefully I'll have better luck than these hunters did yesterday. As far as washing, I'm going to utilize a principle that the Eskimos use in Alaska called the Malkay, which is actually a steam-type bath, but amounts to, I'll build a shelter similar to my lodging shelter. I have a pit there, except the top I'll have a hole in there that I can build a fire in there, and the smoke will go up through the top. I heat rocks on there, and get those rocks red hot. Then I'll have some water, and I'll just douse on the rocks with water. And of course, by this time, I'll have some type of wash basin made that I can wash in there, and then utilize the steam also.
I was wondering how much of your time is taken with this survival meeting. Do you have like 3 times, or are you busy the whole time you're
out? Most of the time you're busy just about all the time.
Uh-huh.
Even if you have plenty of food in store, you're constantly looking around the area and, you know, seemingly if something did happen, you know, what am I going to do? If the shelter's destroyed, what material have I got to replace this shelter? Always looking for animal tracks and checking with, you know, I'll say, studying the animals' habitat. You know.
Have you ever gotten real sick while you're out?
No, I haven't gotten sick.
Have you ever had your shelter destroyed?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that did make me sick. Yeah.
So how do you take care of yourself when you're just getting set up? If you have to spend so much time gathering food and you don't have a shelter built because you don't have your place established, and all you have is a blanket, how do you survive that?
Well, the first thing is I do build a shelter.
Yeah, but wait a minute, it's
going to
take you a couple days to go 30 miles. What are you
going to
do the first couple nights you're out?
Well, there's plenty of natural shelters around the area, too. Find fallen logs and just, you know, if nothing else, stretch your blanket over some fallen logs and anything to break the wind to get in. That's the main thing. When people are out in a situation, they think, well, the first thing I want is a fire or food or water. Well, first thing you want is a shelter, because if you don't have a shelter, then chances are you get hypothermia, and then when you get hypothermia, you're not going to be in, you know, shape too. To build a fire or to get food or water. So I think the main thing you want to build a shelter first. And then after you get your shelter, then you can have your build your fire. And then water is your next most important thing, because you only go a couple days without water. Food, we all get in the habit of eating food all the time, but food, you can go along without food for 3 or 4 weeks. It's not that comfortable, but...
Have you done it?
Believe it or not, yeah, I have.
What kind of tools do you take along? Like a knife? And
I will have a couple knives. And
do you have a folding saw or anything like
that? No, I've got these 2 knives. I've got one is a custom knife that resembles the Bowie knife. It's about 10-12 inch blade. It was custom made by Gary Little out of Newport, Washington. He wants me to field test it. Also, there's another knife company produced by Wilderness Concepts out of Hayden Lake, Idaho. That's a prototype that it's not on the market yet. I'm field testing it. And it's kind of a trader blade type knife, if you're familiar with those, that you can trade the knife blade, and got saw blades that trade. Something similar, but bigger.
What about water? How are you going
to handle the water? Well, of course, this time of year, when it's starting to snow, we can always melt snow for water. Another thing. Snow is generally pretty pure. Some of the other water sources that you get, especially from your lakes, even though your lakes seem like they are, you know, pretty clear and pure, there's very few lakes around the country that are that pure, and it's always a good idea to either boil the water or to if you've got any type of purification tablets with you.
Are you taking
them? No, I'll be boiling them.
Do you take pots and pans in?
No.
What are you boiling in?
Use the rock boiling technique, which amounts to you can either dig a pit, you can heat rocks, and probably a half a gallon of water, you can take about 3 stones, about this big around, that you heated on the fire and drop them in one at a time. As soon as one cools, drop the other one in. And about the time the third or fourth one starts cooling off, the water starts boiling. Stone boiling.
Well, is that in water then?
Pardon me?
You said you didn't have a fire pan, so what do you have the water in?
Oh, we'll make things out of, use a burning technique to, from a branch, make a cup out of a branch. You whittle it with your knife or burn it by using hot coals from a fire to burn it out. Make a bowl, silverware. Well, I've been down the Florida Everglades, been down the Louisiana swamps, Nevada desert, of course up in Alaska for several years, different parts up there. And this book I want to put together, and I didn't mention too much about it, is the fact that I've been interested in survival techniques for the last better than 20 years. And when I was up in Alaska, some of the friends of mine are bush pilots up there. And the type of survival book that I wanted to put together was an index type survival book for the specific location. Say in the Cascades here, if you was plane crashed in the Cascades and you were stranded here, or you're backpacking or whatever, and you were stranded here for a few days or whatever. And this time of year, of course, you need some type of shelter. You're gonna freeze to death or hypothermia because of the wet rains we've got up here. By going through this, if you have this book, go to the index part of it, you can see in the book this type of shelter, this type of natural habitat is available, how to track your animals, what animals are edible, what plants are edible, how to build a shelter without destroying the natural environment of the area. And that's the reason I'm working on debris shelters rather than destroying the natural habitat of the live vegetation.
Is there a point that you have decided where either you're sick or something where you need to come out?
Okay, I'll be...
I can see you haven't reached that, at any time.
It could come to a point that, that I need to come out, and at that time, it could be a dangerous situation because dependent on the weather and climatic conditions. This is my first time in Northern Cascades, and they're talking about, you may be more familiar than me, Barry, about 8, 12, 10 feet, 15 feet of snow. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay.
But they get quite a bit of snow up there, and that could create problems getting out. Right.
Do you ever use, one of the questions I was asked, and I've never used a debris shelter, but do you ever build igloos or snow shelters? Something like that would almost be easier.
Not in this area. Well, of course, I haven't been in this area. In Alaska, and especially the southern part, it's almost impossible because it's a powdery snow. It's not the wet snow that you need. Yeah. And contrary to popular belief, the Eskimo snow shelter did not originate in Alaska. The igloos originated in Canada. It was a Canadian Eskimos.
Oh, how interesting.
So it's just about time for lunch, so...
Well, one last question. When are you leaving?
I stopped in here Tuesday. I was passing through Tuesday. And I've been here ever since. And people ask me, and I say, well, maybe tomorrow. I haven't been out here yet.
Thank you.
Test your fielding.
Thank you.
Put it up by holding the leg.
Thank you.